This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the October 11, 2017 edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. Today I've dipped into Takes on the World archives for a very special program, one that I originally played on May 13, 2015, the likes of which you're not going to find at any other radio station. What you'll hear was recorded at a conference of the National Press Club in Washington on April 10, 2015, that addressed the question of whether or not the Israel lobby was good for the United States or for Israel. The event was sponsored by the Washington Report on the Middle East and the Institute of Research Middle East Policy, whose director, Graham Smith, is a frequent guest on this program. Despite a stellar list of nationally and internationally known speakers appearing before a packed National Press Club audience and the unquestionable relevance of the subject to the American political scene, there was not a single word of the event in the mainstream U.S. media. This was pointed out by Ralph Nader on the Counterpunch website, which was, ironically, the only reporting of the event in the alternative media. All the presentations ran under 20 minutes, which enabled me to put together three that I considered among the most important for an American audience. The first speaker is Israeli-born Miko Peled, author of The General's Son, who now lives in San Diego and whom I interviewed in October 2013. Following Peled will be arguably Israel's most controversial and well-known journalist, Gideon Levy from Haaretz, whom I also interviewed several years back. Concluding the hour will be M.J. Rosenberg, formerly the editor of AIPAC's Near East Report and a veteran of 15 years working for members of Congress on Capitol Hill. Each of the speakers will tell you something about themselves and how they arrive at their current positions. Given the expressed desire by Congress and President Trump to bow to Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and AIPAC's wishes and walk away from the nuclear deal negotiated by the Obama administration with Iran, what you will hear now is perhaps more relevant today than it was 2 years ago. So without further ado, let's begin with Miko Peled.
So the question that was posed to me, it was, is the lobby good for Israel? And my reply would be, or I would answer this with an unequivocal yes. Those of you who have read their book, Mersheimer and Walt, argue that no lobby has managed to divert U.S. policy, U.S. foreign policy, as far from what American national interest would otherwise suggest, while simultaneously convincing Americans that U.S. and Israeli interests are essentially identical. They continue to say AIPAC's success is due to its ability to reward legislators and congressional candidates who support its agenda and to punish those who challenge it. AIPAC makes sure that its friends get strong financial support from the myriad pro-Israeli PACs. Those seen as hostile to Israel, on the other hand, can be sure that AIPAC will direct campaign contributions to their opponents. The bottom line is that AIPAC, which is a de facto agent of a foreign government, has a stranglehold on the U.S. Congress. Open debate about U.S. policy towards Israel does not occur there, even though that policy has important consequences for the entire world. One could really end the discussion here, probably, with that statement on its own, but I think this issue deserves a lengthier discussion. I think that AIPAC and the State of Israel, which benefits from AIPAC's work, owe much of its success to its predecessors, a group of Zionist diplomats who began as early as the turn of the last century and by the 1920s were already traveling extensively around the world, lobbying for the Zionist project and for the funding and implementation of the project, basically the project being the colonization of Palestine by European Jews. Without the huge efforts and diplomatic talent of these people, who included Chaim Weizmann, Moshe Sharet, my own grandfather Avram Katznelson, later on Abba Ibn and Golda Meir, to name but a few, without these people and their work, Zionism could not have enjoyed the success it had in the years leading up to the Zionist occupation of Palestine and the establishment of the State of Israel. The lobbying by the early Zionist diplomats, all of whom, by the way, were well-spoken, highly educated, completely secular, they were all white Europeans and looked nothing like traditional Jews that the world was accustomed to seeing, their work paved the way to AIPAC and its tentacles here in the U.S. and in other countries in the West where Zionists needed support. In order to appreciate AIPAC's enormous contribution to Israel, I think we need to do two things. We need to understand what the what this organization is ultimately selling and understand its strategy. A key to Israel's legitimacy is the Zionist narrative. And AIPAC is selling the narrative in order to maintain the legitimacy. The Zionist narrative in this country is not only accepted, it is treated with religious fervor. It is seen as biblical and indisputable. One does not need to convince Americans that Israel is always right and that the Zionist narrative is true because they receive this with their mother's milk, quite literally. And what is this narrative? It is a mythical story that turned the history of Palestine from 1947 until the present time on its head. The brutal ethnic cleansing of Palestine, the establishment of a racist apartheid state, which offers exclusive rights to Jewish people in Palestine, was sold here as a story of heroism and revival. Thanks to AIPAC, the horrific, brutal destruction of Palestine from 1947 to the present day is virtually unknown in this country. That in itself is an impressive accomplishment without which Israel could not have survived. And there is no better proof of that success than the reaction here in the U.S. to the 51-day massacre of innocents in Gaza that took place in the summer of 2014. More than 2,000 people were murdered in cold blood in Gaza on prime time. Yet we may safely say that there was a consensus in this country that this massacre was not only acceptable and justifiable, but necessary as a means of self-defense. To achieve this is nothing short of magic, and AIPAC was able to pull this through. When Israel, through AIPAC and the countless organizations that work with it and through it, talks about a threat to Israeli security, they mean a threat to the narrative. Since the early 1950s, Israel has been claiming that Palestinians in the Gaza Strip pose a threat to its security, indeed, to its very existence. The Israeli army has been attacking in Gaza and exacting a heavy toll on civilians in Gaza for nearly 7 decades. Yet, surprisingly, there has never been a tank, a fighter jet, or a regular military remotely capable of threatening the state of Israel. Why then do we hear so much about a security threat when now, as in the past, the Gaza Strip is made up of mostly poor refugees? It is the narrative. The existence of over 1 million refugees in Gaza, the majority of whom are under 18 years of age, is a threat to the narrative and therefore a threat to the legitimacy of the state of Israel. And therein lies the threat to Israeli existence. AIPAC has been able to successfully sell the myth of the existential threat to the American public. We constantly hear about the threats to Israeli existence, though clearly there has never been one. The threat of Gaza, the threat of Palestinians everywhere, the threat of Iraq, the threat of Iran, the threat of SJP, as we heard earlier, are all fabricated in order to allow Israel to maintain its brutal hold on Palestine and its people and to receive foreign aid, though clearly, as a developed state, it does not need and should not qualify for it. The myth of Israel as a democracy has no factual basis, yet it too has become an indisputable fact. Israel has from the very beginning defined itself as a racist apartheid state that prefers Jews. No attempt has been made to hide this fact, and for almost 7 decades, Israeli lawmakers have made it their business to develop the state for the Jewish population at the expense of the Palestinian population, be they citizens, residents, or simply people living without any legal definition at all. Palestinians have been pushed out of every aspect of the life of the state from the very beginning, not to mention the fact that they were pushed out of the country and not allowed to return. The web of laws that govern the lives of Palestinians, whether they live in Yaffa, in Haifa, in Jerusalem, in the Negev Desert, in Ramallah, Jenin, or in Khan Yunis, is too complicated to even attempt to understand. Yet regardless of where in Palestine Palestinians reside, they are governed by the State of Israel under laws that are vastly different than the ones that govern the lives of Jewish Israelis. And still we hear that Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East. Israeli occupation of the West Bank, which took place in June of 1967, is sold as though it was the result of an inevitable war, a response to an existential threat at the end of which Israelis prevailed and the territories are the spoils of war. But in fact, the conquest of East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip were the final stage of the occupation of Palestine, and all were planned far in advance. The war of 1967 concluded and completed the occupation of Palestine and the creation of a single state over all of Palestine with exclusive rights for Jewish people. What is Jewish about this, as Alice Rothschild asked earlier, I don't know. Most Jewish people don't live there. The majority of the people who do live there are not Jewish, and Israel certainly does not espouse any Jewish values. Yet, we hear that Israel is the Jewish state. None of this could have been achieved without a strong and influential lobby. AIPAC is engaged in convincing Americans that U.S. and Israeli interests are essentially identical, as I mentioned earlier. But there is no need to convince Americans that Israel is right because, like I said earlier, they receive it with their mother's milk. So much so that in cases where the interests of the two countries collide, the demand is always for the U.S. to adjust its policy so as to align with Israeli interests and not the other way around. And we saw this example recently, about a month ago, with Netanyahu's very successful campaign stop here at the Capitol and with the Iran issue. One has to wonder, how is it that a false history is kept alive in the face of clear evidence to its being untrue? Well, you can imagine my surprise when I looked at my son's high school history book. My boys went to school in San Diego. And AP World History book, and found that the entire chapter regarding the ancient Hebrews is taken from the Old Testament. My first reaction was to make sure I was actually looking at a history book. The second reaction was to see if the beginning of the book begins with a story of creation, of the creation, basically teaching creationism, because they may as well have been. In a country where there is a debate still over whether creationism should be taught in school or evolution, the Zionist narrative, which claims its roots in biblical stories of the ancient Hebrews, is taught as history, although little to no historical proof exists to substantiate it. This sort of influence can only be achieved through years and years of hard work, an effort to instill the narrative as a value and not just as an historical episode. This can only be done, again, by a lobby that knows how to influence society. Along this vein, AIPAC and the other Zionist groups, all of whom are in the business of selling the Zionist narrative, engage in community development and service activities that root them well in communities across the country. Validation and acceptance of the Zionist narrative are an integral part of almost all of these efforts, as well as the delegitimization of any Palestinian claims to a legitimate narrative which contradicts the Zionist story. The Zionist narrative is a value that goes hand in hand with democracy, freedom, and tolerance, while the Palestinian narrative is associated with lies, hatred, violence, and bigotry. Today we see serious cracks in the wall that AIPAC was able to build around the issue of Palestine. It has been severely weakened due to the diligence and tremendous work being done, like we heard earlier, on campuses by Students for Justice. For the first time, we see a change in the conversation on Palestine, and the level of the debate on this issue has been elevated, again, thanks to SJP. So it would seem that the big bad lobby AIPAC has now finally met its match with Students for Justice in Palestine on campuses. But still, we see plenty of tolerance workshops and initiatives to weed out racism and anti-Semitism, and this was done recently at UCLA, where one of my son is a junior. And these take place in schools and universities all across the U.S. Within these seemingly benign and positive initiatives, the Zionist narrative and the delegitimization of Palestinians are pursued with vigilance. The persecution of Palestinians in the U.S., which is a crucial element in the survival of the Zionist narrative and the legitimacy of Israel, is also the work of a well-oiled lobby. Nothing, I believe, demonstrates this better than the closure, prosecution, trial, and convictions of the Holy Land Foundation and the five men who operated it. This could not have been achieved without tremendous behind-the-scenes work and years of preparation. It was one of the clearest cases of injustice in the history of America, of the American judicial system, and it has the Israeli lobby fingerprints all over it. The Holy Land Foundation did not engage in terrorist activities, nor did they fund or support terrorism in any way. This was made absolutely clear in their trials. Yet five men were convicted and are currently serving prison sentences of 20 to 65 years in maximum security jails. Why was this necessary? Because a respected, successful, and honest Muslim-Palestinian charity is a threat to the narrative and to the legitimacy of the State of Israel. So the Holy Land Foundation, its operators, its major contributors, and an entire community had to be taken down. And though it took almost two decades and two trials, this mission was accomplished. AIPAC's success is due to its ability to reward legislators and congressional candidates who support its agenda and to punish those who challenge it. It starts, in fact, at a much lower level. Members of small and seemingly insignificant city councils, as well as large ones, are invited to junkets, as we all know, to see Israel. Connections to AIPAC are developed very early in a politician's career so that every aspiring politician in the U.S. understands that supporting Israel, even if it means turning a blind eye to terrible crimes, even if it means giving Netanyahu, who stands at the head of a racist, brutal regime and who oversaw the cold-blooded murder of thousands of civilians in Gaza just a few months ago, again, even if it means receiving him with a standing ovation, it is necessary for success in American politics. Maintaining Israeli legitimacy and keeping the narrative alive is key. It is the most important strategic objective for Israel, and therefore it is so for AIPAC. We can clearly say that AIPAC is and always has been not only good, but crucial to the existence of the State of Israel. Thank you very much.
And that was Miko Peled. His grandfather signed the Declaration of Independence for Israel. He was followed by Gideon Levy, who was the most influential, controversial, I should say, and well-known columnist in Israel for Haaretz. Gideon Levy.
Thank you very much for having me here today. Never was I so convinced that Israel and the United States are really sharing the same values after listening to all those fascinating presentations today, because by the end of the day, we are dealing with two regimes which are very, very similar, with two regimes that very little to do with democracy, and I will get to it. I was born in Tel Aviv. I was brought up in Tel Aviv. I was a very good boy, Tel Aviv. I served in the Israeli army. I did even something which is much worse than this. I worked for 4 years with Shimon Peres, then leader of Israeli opposition in the late 70s, early 80s, before most of you were born. And it was only by the late 80s when I started to travel to the occupied territories quite accidentally, when I realized, as a journalist, when I realized that the biggest drama of Israel is taking place half an hour away from our homes, in our dark backyard, that this real drama of Israel has almost no one to be interested in, that it is hidden in the back yard of Israel, half an hour away from our homes. All those crimes are taking place, and we Israelis, most of us, if not all of us, do not want to know, do not know, and above all, do not care. And it took me many, many years to understand how come. How come that a society, some of you met Israelis, they are not monsters, every catastrophe in the world, the Israelis are always the first one to send rescue teams with field hospitals. Many Israelis would help any old lady to cross the road many times, even if she doesn't want to cross the road. People with values. How come that this society lives for so many years with this drama in its backyard and feels so good about itself and has so little moral doubts, if at all? How is it possible? How is it possible that most of the Israelis, if not all of them, are deeply convinced that the IDF is the most moral army in the world? Try to tell an Israeli, and I tried it once or twice, you know what, maybe it's the second moral army in the world. Maybe the army of Luxembourg is more moral. I don't know if Luxembourg has an army at all. They will be deeply offended. How can you dare? How come that when this reality is taking place so close to our homes, not over the oceans, but just half an hour away from our homes, how come that we live in peace with it, that we continue with it, that there is no resistance, almost nothing? And here I want to object to what my friend Miko said. When I got first the invitation to come here, the first words were Israel Lobby. I said, wow, they invite me. AIPAC is inviting me. And then I said, that's the chance of my life. And I'm going to come there to Washington and to tell them, listen, with friends like yours, Israel does not need enemies. But unfortunately, but then I continued to read and I read that I'm privileged to be invited to another forum, not exactly AIPAC, and even not the Anti-Defamation League. But I can say it from here, Miko. I think that we are dealing with a corrupting friendship. I think that if it wouldn't be the Israel lobby, Israel would have been today a better place to live in. Israel would have been a more just place. And I think that if it wouldn't be the Israel lobby, the United States would have been a better place and a more democratic place. But it's not for me to judge the American politics. And still, by the end of the day, we are dealing with an enigma. Because nothing can explain it. Nothing can explain how administration after administration, legislators after legislators, are going in the very same way, which contradicts American interest in so many cases, which contradicts international law, human rights, moral values, you name it. Can it be only this small group, as powerful as it is? Is it the full explanation? I doubt it, but that's for you to decide, not for us in Israel. But for us in Israel, it, or at least for me, it is very clear. Think about a relative of yours or a friend of yours who is, God forbid, a drug addict. There are two ways to deal with him. One is to supply him with money and he will go and buy more drugs. He will be very grateful to you. He will appreciate you. He will tell you, you love me, you are my friend, you are my best friend. The other way is to send him to a rehabilitation center. He will be so mad at you. But what is real care? And what is real love? And what is real friendship? And does anyone in this hall have the slightest doubt that Israel is occupation addicted? But, and therefore for me, this conference here is so crucial and so important. Because we have to face reality. And reality is that there is no chance for a change from within the Israeli society. No way. I'll try to explain why. But if this is the case, the only hope is for an international intervention, and the only hope is from this place, from Washington, from the United States, from the EU, only from there. Because the Israeli society is by far today too brainwashed. Life in Israel is by far too good. And Israel, let's face it, is a society which lives in denial, totally disconnected with reality. Would it be a private person? I would recommend either medications or hospitalization, because people who lose connection with reality might be very dangerous, either to themselves or to society. And the Israel lost connection with reality. It lost connection with the reality in its backyard. It's totally lost connection with the international environment. Really, to believe that 5 million Jews know better than 6 billion people of the world? Really believe that 5 million Jews will be able to continue to live on the sword forever? Is there one example in history in which any country lived on its sword forever? Empires? Really believing that in the 21st century it is acceptable to ignore the international law in such a way, to ignore the international institutions, and to rely only on the United States and Micronesia? Let's not forget this friend of Israel. And recently also Czech Republic. Thank you, Czech Republic. And Canada, your neighbor, obviously. Does it work? Had it ever worked? So therefore it is so crucial for people like me to see any kind of change here in the United States. And we jump on any sign. When J Street was established, we say, yeah, here it comes. And it didn't come. When Obama was elected, I had tears in my eyes. I said, here it comes. And it didn't come. And when I see conferences like here today, again, it gives me some hope that change might happen, because change will have to take place here. In Israel, it's a lost case. Forget about it. The Israeli society had surrounded itself with shields, with walls, not only physical walls, but also mental walls. I don't want to get into it because it's another lecture, but I'll just give the three principles which enable us Israelis to live so easily with this brutal reality. A, most of the Israelis, if not all of them, deeply believe that we are the chosen people. And if we are the chosen people, we have the right to do whatever we want. B, there were more brutal occupations in history. There were even longer occupations in history, even though the Israeli occupation gets to quite a nice record. But there was never in history an occupation in which the occupier presented himself as the victim. Not only the victim, the only victim around. This also enabled any Israeli to live in peace, because we are the victims. The other day, Professor Falk spoke about this dual strategy of Israel, of being a victim on one hand and manipulating the other on the other hand. After what happened in Paris and in Copenhagen with the terror attacks, Benjamin Netanyahu came with the notion, all the Jews must come to Israel. It's the safest place for the Jews in the world. It's a shelter for the Jews in the world. Which is wrong, because Israel is today the most dangerous place on earth for Jews, but let's put it aside. It was only 24 hours later when he said Israel is an existential threat under the Iranian bomb. And I asked myself, how can you dare call Jews to come and to join this suicidal project when the Iranians are going to bomb us? But in Israel, everything goes, and both declarations were accepted as the only truth. And here I get to the third set of values which enable us Israelis to live in peace with the occupation. And this is maybe the most crucial one and the worst one. We said victimization, we said chosen people. When I say victimization, it goes without saying we have to mention the Holocaust and the unforgettable Mrs. Golda Meir that the American jury had exported to Israel. She said once, this unforgettable woman, that after the Holocaust, the Jews have the right to do whatever they want. But the third set of values is the most dangerous one, and this is the systematic dehumanization of the Palestinians, which enable us Israelis to live in peace with everything, because if they are not human beings like us, then there is not really a question of human rights. And if you scratch under the skin of almost every Israeli, you will find it there. Almost no one will treat the Palestinians as equal human beings like us. I once wrote that we treat the Palestinians like animals, and I got so many protest letters from animal rights organizations, rightly so. But by the end of the day, how many Israelis did ever try for a moment to put themselves in the place of the Palestinians for a moment, for one day? And I want to give you two examples which will demonstrate it. Many years ago, I interviewed then candidate for Prime Minister Ehud Barak, and I asked him a question which I try to ask in any occasion. Mr. Barak, what would have happened if you would have been born Palestinian? And Barak gave me then the only honest answer he could give me. He said I would have joined a terror organization. What else would have he done? Would he become a poet? He doesn't know to write poems. Would he become a pianist? He's quite a bad pianist, and I doubt if he would have become a collaborator, because he is a fighter. And it became a scandal, because how can you dare to put Ehud Barak to think what would have happened if he would have become a Palestinian? And the second incident, briefly, Second Intifada, the city of Jenin, the most closed city in the West Bank, real total siege. I go out from Jenin, I come to the checkpoint, a Palestinian ambulance is parking there with the red lights. I stand after him, no cars can get out of Jenin in those days, no cars can get in, and I wait. The soldiers are playing Begamon in the tent. Usually I know myself, it's better that I don't get into a confrontation with the soldiers because it always ends up very badly. So I stayed in the car. But after 40 minutes, I couldn't take it. And I went out to the car. From the car, I went first to the Palestinian ambulance driver and asked him, what's going on? He told me that's the routine. They let me wait 1 hour until they come and check the ambulance. And I couldn't take it anymore. And I went to the soldiers. It became a confrontation. But the question that I asked them, which really brought them to direct their weapons toward me, was one. What would have happened if your father would have been lying in this ambulance? This freaked them out. They lost control. How can I dare to compare between their father and the Palestinian in the ambulance? And this set of beliefs that they are not human beings like us enable us Israelis to live in so much peace with those crimes, ongoing crime for so many years, with losing any kind of humanity, values. I heard today people talk about Jewish values. I must be frank with you, I don't know what are Jewish values. I know what are universal values. Let's not get into it, really. There are very clear universal values. And there is a very, very clear international law. But for most of the Israelis, international law is very important. But not for Israel. Israel is a special case. Why is it a special case? And again, you get with all those set of values, with this living in denial. And here I want to get back to the topic of our panel. Is it good for Israel? No, it's very corrupting. Because as long as the United States enable Israel to continue, obviously the Palestinians are the first and direct, unbelievable victim of it. But by the end of the day, What will Israel be after all those years? What is it already today? Where does it direct to? And things are getting worse and worse. And therefore, I have so little hope about change from within the Israeli society. Because things, as you might know, are going more and more to the nationalistic, militaristic, religious direction, with very little hope that change will come from within. Why would Israelis go for a change? What incentive? Why would they bother? Life is so good. You should have seen Israel in the days when Gaza was bombed, when the beaches were crowded, the helicopters were passing on the way to bomb Gaza. The Israeli TV hardly showed photos from there. Newspapers hardly wrote anything. I wrote one article about the responsibility of the pilots, and I needed to use bodyguards to get out of my home after this. The problem was, by the way, that the bodyguards were settlers, and they argued with me all day long until I saw that I'm much more secure without the bodyguards rather than with them. But the last war in Gaza, and this will be my final remarks, the last war in Gaza taught us also that Israel, which has three regimes today, maybe the only country, in the only state in the world with three regimes, one for the Jews, one for the Arab citizens, and one, an apartheid regime in the West Bank and Gaza, one of the most brutal and cruel tyrannies in the world. But even for the facade, even for this democracy, which I always thought is a democracy for its Jewish citizens, I realized last summer that it is a democracy for its Jewish citizens, but only if they think like the majority. And therefore, and by this I want to conclude, I want to tell you all that few of us, very few, much too few, but few of us are looking to the West, Europe, and then United States, with a great hope, because we lost hope in Israel. Thank you very much.
And that was Gideon Levy, the incomparable Gideon Levy, columnist for Haaretz. And he was followed by M.J. Rosenberg, who is a former staff member for AIPAC, and he'll tell you about his experience and his opinions.
I have to say I was struck listening to Gideon Levy from Haaretz that he writes for a major Israeli paper. It's everybody reads Haaretz worldwide, but in Israel itself, and he gets away saying things that he could never say here. If Gideon Levy worked in the United States, the lobby would have him fired. There is no question about that. And that's why when you watch MSNBC and you wait for people that you like who are liberals and progressives to say something good on the Palestinians, they never will. And in that regard, Israel is infinitely ahead of the United States, which means Israel has one really great thing to say about itself. There's no Israel lobby here. And there's just Israel, which is... It just struck me listening to him. He has no equivalent in the United States. I have a somewhat unique perspective on AIPAC, and I was employed there for 6 years as a volunteer for 2 years in the 70s, as a senior staffer in the 80s, but I also did see them from Capitol Hill, where I worked for 15 years for Democratic House members and senators. One of my tasks at AIPAC was writing its manual about Israel and the Arabs, designed to be used as a guide by students, congressional staffers, rabbis, etc., to defend Israel against the lies being told by the other side. It's called Myths and Facts. Although inside of AIPAC it was always called Myths and Myths. You know, myth. This is standard Hasbara. Myth. They say the Palestinians were driven from their homes by the Israeli army in 1948. Fact. The Palestinians actually left their homes in what became Israel in search of better lives in the West Bank and Gaza. That was part of my job, was writing this stuff, but these myths have been around much longer than I've been. I will use the frame myths and facts to address the most common misconceptions about AIPAC as I see them. And I want to clarify at this point, I left AIPAC in 1986, and after that I've only dealt with them from the outside, from Capitol Hill, and you know, not as a staffer. I didn't leave there under bad terms. I wasn't fired from AIPAC. In fact, when I left in 86, it wasn't as right wing as it subsequently became. So I'm not grinding an axe when I tell you, when you hear my feelings about that organization that was my employer. But the first myth I want to deal with is kind of a pro-AIPAC myth. It is that AIPAC's role in intimidating members of Congress to support its demands through the use of financial pressure and intimidation is unique. That this pressure is an aberration invented by Israel's supporters to advance the Israel's government's goals. Fact, AIPAC is not an aberration. Basically, every decision Congress makes is made with an eye on who has the money and how can a legislator either get some of it or avoid it being deployed against them. No, not every decision is based on money. But issues like abortion, for instance, which is a religious kind of issue, is not based on money. But everything else is. Most notably issues relating to banks, guns, Wall Street, labor, regulations to protect consumer, healthcare, the environment, etc. And especially combating any effort to prevent or reduce the effects of climate change. Like when the Koch brothers fight and lobby and use their money to prevent the development of alternative energy sources. I can hardly think of anything that AIPAC does that is less patriotic than the fact that the Koch brothers and their lobby go out there into state legislatures and city councils to make sure that they don't authorize wind farms to allow us to be less dependent on Middle East oil. They don't care about the Middle East oil part, they care about money in their own pocket. That's our system today. Yes, Middle East policy is determined by the highest bidder, which is AIPAC. But pretty much every policy discussed on Capitol Hill is determined by those with the money. If that means that democracy in America is itself a myth, so be it. Because frankly, that is what I believe. It is not just AIPAC that is all about the money. It is everything that comes before Congress. And that's a fact. And I say that for 15 years of being up there and watching it and benefiting from it too. Because you raise money for your bosses from the special interests that want them to do stuff for them. The lobby supporters, of course, argue that it is love for Israel, the supposed fellow democracy, that is behind its support. But that was never evident to me. Yes, there are members of Congress who are true believers who, quote, love Israel and are sincerely devoted to its interests as those legislatures or Netanyahu sees those interests. But they are very few. In fact, of the 29 Jewish legislators currently serving, most had little or no involvement with Israel before entering politics, with most making their first visits to Israel as either candidates for office or once they were able to visit on free junkets. Yes, they all talk about loving Israel, about having grown up on Israel, about learning about Israel in Hebrew school, but take it with a grain of salt. Barney Frank, now retired, who was a reliable AIPAC supporter, talked a good game about his love for Israel. But it wasn't intense enough to merit more than one reference in his just published 300-page autobiography. And he just mentions it in passing with a whole bunch of other countries. Where was Barney's love? It's not in his book. It's not there. Yes, most of the Jews in Congress care about Israel. Most Jews do. But that care would likely lead them to support dovish positions and not mindless hawkishness were it not for the lobby and the financial benefits of staying in its good graces. After all but one of the Jewish members of Congress are Democrats and liberals who hold dovish views on every other foreign policy issue except Israel, where for some reason they become raving hawks. Same with non-Jewish Democratic supporters of Israel. Same thing. Honestly, can anyone believe that Bernie Sanders really believed that the Gaza war was a good idea? Or Elizabeth Warren? Or Al Franken? Or any of the other big-time progressive types who supported it or at the very least refused to condemn it? Not even expressing a word of sympathy for the killing of kids on a beach. They couldn't say it. If you watch, there are tapes. You see them on YouTube of Bernie Sanders screaming at constituents who brought up the slaughter in Gaza and Elizabeth Warren literally running away from a constituent who asked a question. The same applies to the Democrats who are joining Republicans to fight the Iran agreement. These are people who always favor diplomacy over war and certainly who support their Democratic president, especially when it comes to a diplomatic breakthrough like this, but not this time. At this point, we don't know how many Democrats will fight Obama on lifting Iran sanctions, but it may be enough to override his veto. Just think about that. Congressmen voting to override a veto by a president from their own party. Why would they do that? The answer is that their position on this issue of war and peace is dictated by their determination to please AIPAC donors. Chuck Schumer deserves special mention here. The next leader of Democrats in the Senate. His rise to the majority leader post, or minority, whatever when he comes in, majority or minority leader, does not stem only from his charm, brilliance, or ability to place himself in front of television cameras. It comes from his ability to raise money from his base, which is viewed as, and in fact is, Wall Street and pro-Israel donors. Schumer no more loves Israel than he loves Wall Street. But he loves the money that these two sources provide to his campaign coffers. And through his efforts as the Democratic Senate, as chair of the Democratic Campaign Committee, to his colleagues in the Democratic Party itself, he became head of the campaign committee, would raise money from AIPAC, raise money from Wall Street, and then dole it out to all his friends in the party who are up for re-election. And then they know where it comes from. This is important to note. Pro-Israel donors and AIPAC give so much money to candidates that the Democratic Party has for years been choosing only those closest to the lobby to run their campaign fundraising operations. That is why Rahm Emanuel got to be chair of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, putting him both in place to block any candidate not sympathetic to AIPAC from running, which he did. He also blocked Arab Americans from running for Congress, and to grease his ascent to the top. And that is why ambitious Democrats will do all they can to defeat Obama on Iran. It's good for business. As the song goes, what's love got to do with it? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Of course, there are the Christian conservatives who do love Israel or say they do. Today, a large part of that love is, in fact, motivated by hatred of Barack Obama. Netanyahu has made himself President Obama's enemy, so conservative Republicans love him. And many love him in Israel for sincere reasons, religious or because they view Israel as a bulwark against the Muslims. Unlike legislators on the left, however, they are not hypocrites when it comes to Israel. I have nothing good to say about John McCain, Ted Cruz, Lindsey Graham, or the rest of them, but their views on Israel fits in with their worldview, which is that force works and diplomacy never does. Their support for Israel up till now has not been bought because it didn't have to be bought. Although according to this past Sunday's New York Times, Republicans are now joining Democrats in terms of getting paid for their devotion to Israel, something Senator Tom Cotton discovered when he wrote his letter to the president of Iran and was paid $1 million. He probably does not need AIPAC money to win re-election in Arkansas, but the Harvard-educated veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan has his sights set higher than that. His devotion to the cause will certainly help him get there, and has already. In general, though, the conservatives don't matter much on matters relating to Israel. One, even for the most zealous defender of Israel in the Republican caucus, Israel is not central to them or their fundraising. Not central to the way fighting against gays or abortions or Obama or illegal immigration. Those are all their big issues. Yes, there is Sheldon Adelson and a few others who give money to right-wing candidates, but given that 80% of Jews are Democrats, as are the overwhelming majority of Jewish donors, these Christian conservatives are pretty insignificant in terms of the big picture. In all my years on Capitol Hill, I never heard a single staff member say that they had to vote for some Palestinians don't exist resolution that was on the House floor because they're afraid of the Christians. No, they're afraid of AIPAC, and AIPAC is not a Christian organization. The fear is awesome to behold. In 2006, this is amazing, the White House and the Israeli government agreed on an $86 million aid for the Palestinian Authority to strengthen the PA to help it withstand the Hamas threat. I remember talking to the leading Democrat on the House Appropriation Committee. She had heard from the Israeli government that they wanted this $86 million to go to the Palestinians, and that they, in fact, had drawn up the package with the State Department. So she said, that being the case, she'll support it. Next thing I heard, she was opposing it. In fact, she said she would cut the sum in half, which she did. I paid her another call. Why had she changed her mind with the president and the Israeli prime minister in agreement behind it? She said, after she spoke to me about it, she met with a senior AIPAC lobbyist who told her to cut it in half. I asked her why, and she said, they don't think it's the right time. So it's not just the United States government that Israel is stronger than, it's the Israeli government too. Now, this legislator has a safe seat, but like Schumer, she was always in the fundraising business for herself, for other candidates, and she also became head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. Her loyalty was not to Israel, but to AIPAC itself. After all, the Israeli government may be calling the shots, but it is AIPAC that is coordinating the PACs, and far more important than the PACs, the individual donors. A lot more money goes to members of Congress from individual donors than from PACs. I saw on the news the other day that Congressman Chris Van Hollen, who is running for and likely to win the Democratic nomination for Senator from Maryland, has raised $1 million for his Senate campaign and has $2 million more in the bank. That would not be the case had he not changed his tune on Israel. Back in 2006, Chris Van Hollen got into deep hot water with the lobby when he criticized Israel's conduct of the war with Hezbollah. He expressed support for Secretary Condoleezza Rice's statement that Israel was not taking care to avoid civilian casualties. Poor Chris. He was new then, didn't know that such an audacious stand, expressing support for his own Secretary of State, would cause the lobby to go nuts. But it did. He was summoned to explain himself to the Jewish Community Council of Greater Washington, the local branch of the lobby, which he did. And then he issued a statement which retracted his statement. His earlier statement, but his mea culpas were not accepted. So they insisted that he go to Israel and do his repentance there. And he did. The lobby's type still didn't trust him, but now, a decade later, with Chris Van Hollen demonstrating his devotion, he is the lobby's candidate, with his opponent, Representative Donna Edwards, assigned the former Chris Van Hollen role of Israel critic. Last week, he said he was asked by the Baltimore Jewish paper why he had ever done that in 2006. What were you thinking? He said there was a situation where there were some differences with the community. The goals were the same, they're always the same, which is to ensure the safety of Israel. We have shared values, shared priorities. And this issue, that's going to be one of the biggest issues in Maryland, is in the primary, is going to be that Donna Edwards is an enemy of Israel, the Jewish people, and all. None of it's true. But this, and Chris Van Hollen, who has the same views as she does, he smartly insulated him against them by making all his apologies. That is the way it's been for the past 30 years. That may be changing or not, something we will not know until we see how the effort to roll back the Iran agreement goes. The Iran agreement is something the Israelis and the lobby will not tolerate, which is why they're going to the mat to defeat this deal. If they succeed in defeating the agreement, and simultaneously President Obama, with the support of two-thirds of Congress that they induced to support Netanyahu, they will be viewed correctly as stronger than ever. They never brought down a president before. This will be a first. If, however, Obama succeeds in putting over this agreement, The lobby will be badly damaged, not only because they lost, but because in the process, they are exposed as an ally of right-wing Republicans, not the bipartisan organization they claim to be. With the polls showing that Israel itself is increasingly out of favor with the Democratic base, they could be on the road to extinction. But we can't know that now. I can say, however, that I'm optimistic, but not too optimistic. Let me conclude by congratulating American Educational Trust and the Institute for Research in Middle Eastern Policy for convening this incredibly timely conference. Back when I first started AIPAC, Steve Rosen, who was my boss and was later indicted for espionage against the United States, I know, like, he's still around though. You're allowed to get indicted for espionage. Depends who you're doing it for. He sent me a now famous memo. It's now famous because I gave it to the Washington Post. He wrote, he warned me not to ever talk, this is my second day there, never to talk about AIPAC activities outside the lobby. He wrote, a lobby is a night flower. It thrives in the dark and shrivels up in the sunlight. I think that may be happening now thanks to all our efforts. If it does, not only the United States, but Israel, the Palestinians, and the world will be better off. This night flower needs crushing.
That was former AIPAC staff member M.J. Rosenberg, despite a bad cold, addressing the issue of the Israel lobby and his former employer at a conference at the National Press Club in Washington in April 2015. Immediately before that, you heard Haaretz columnist Gideon Levy, Israel's best-known internal dissenter, and leading off the program was Miko Peled, son of former Israeli general and peace activist Matti Peled, who now resides in San Diego and has become one of the leading advocates for justice for Palestine in the U.S. The entire conference can be viewed at IsraelLobbyUS.org. This has been Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.